This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. You and I step into a virtual room crammed with reference books, charts and maps and get clear answers to today's burning questions from the experts who know what they're talking about. Now, whether we bring enlightenment or just cause confusion, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. Recent reviewers include Alex Milliner, Safia Butterfly and Pusey Lucy. Join them and I'll read out your handle too. This week, we're asking, how bad is the air we're breathing and how can we make it cleaner? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might want to download other editions of The Briefing Room. In recent podcasts, we've covered Turkey's economy, chaos on the railways and nationalisation. A few weeks ago, a large group of the nation's mayors and local leaders signed a letter calling for urgent action on air pollution. So here, inside the briefing room today, I'm going to find out how big a problem this really is and what the potential solutions might be. But first, because air pollution tends to be an outside thing, let's take to the streets. Well, to try and find out how good or bad the air is here in London, I've stepped outside. We're actually in London Bridge underneath the Shard near to the station, where I'm joined by Andrew Grieve. He's Senior Air Quality Analyst with the Environmental Research Group at King's College London. Andrew, you're a big student of air quality and you've got your phone out. What have you got there?
This is like a live map showing us pollution across the city. So where we're standing here, you can see obviously the junction just down the street and London Bridge area around there. You can pick out the road network where the pollution is higher. I mean, at the moment you can feel this breeze and so it's quite good.
What does quite good mean?
So the UK has a scale, an index that goes from low to moderate to high to very high. So generally if you look at the picture at the moment, most of what we can see is green, which is in the
and
low.
I'm looking at the app that's in your hand and so on. It's got a map and actually it's one of those things that has the kind of buildings in relief.
Yeah.
So what kind of colours am I looking out for which show you the lows or highs?
Greens and blues here, which are all low because it's mostly low today. But even though we've got greens and lows, you can still pick out the road network in comparison to kind of the background areas and nearer the river. But if we change the view onto this annual map, so this is an annual map which shows you what pollution is like generally across the year.
In this place.
You can still see the road network there, obviously. But what this is showing us is that anything that's yellow or above is above the UK guideline for nitrogen dioxide.
Well, everything's yellow or above. Yeah. In fact, what I'm looking at is, except for the river is actually showing that it's not kind of quite, well, bits of it are kind of yellowish. Everything that's not the road is yellow. And then quiet bits of blocks near the roads are actually much darker than that. They're reds. In some places, they're actually black.
Yes, particularly junctions there. and some of the kind of what we call street canyons, where you've got high buildings on either side of the road that trap the pollution in. We have several roads in London which are two or three times the annual limit, and that's what you're seeing on these kind of black and red areas here on the map.
So if I'm standing in the area, which I can see there, now that we're looking at the area around Elephant Castle, which is not that far away,
yeah.
And it really is solid black around there, what am I breathing in if I'm standing in that area?
So the two main pollutants that you're breathing in from traffic there, you know, it's a very congested traffic area, are nitrogen dioxide, which is a result of combustion, and also particulates. So there's particulates from the exhaust, little bits of unburnt carbon that come out. That's the black soot that you see. But there's also little bits of tyre wear as the tyres are rolling along the road, and brake wear as well. So bits of metals that come off the brake wear as they wear down. And all of that kind of is suspended in the air, and then as you get closer to the traffic, that's what you're breathing in. Now, the problem that we have is that obviously we're in close proximity to the traffic in our urban lives, and over the long term, as you breathe that in kind of over your lifetime, it's that kind of cumulative effect that has the health effect.
Now, I want to establish this quite clearly. Although it is true that by far and away the biggest concentration, several times the level, are by the roads, all the background is yellow, yep. i.e. above the recommended levels. The whole thing.
Yeah, in central London, yeah, on a kind of annual basis, yes, it is. So, you know, we've got a long way to go, particularly for nitrogen dioxide, to get it under control.
Now, my oldest daughter's a runner. She quite often runs through central London, sometimes at these times. Is that good for her?
Well, two things. One, run in the park. Don't run along Euston Road. Don't run along Marylebone Road. And secondly, when it gets to summertime, and we get ozone episodes, and so, you know, we had a very hot summer this year. What happens with ozone is it builds through the day and it peaks in the late afternoon. So if you're going to go running in the summertime, go in the morning when the levels are lower.
Andrew Grieve. Safely back inside, let's now dig down a little more into what's happening across the country and what it means for our health. Joining me in the briefing room is Fiona Godley, editor of the BMJ, one of the world's oldest medical journals. Fiona Godley, you heard our introduction there. Looking at it more broadly, what actually is happening to us physically as a consequence of air pollution?
So the air pollution we breathe in has really quite a wide range of effects on the human body. And I think we're beginning to understand exactly how wide. So it's not just the things we used to talk about, asthma and chronic lung disease. It's also heart disease and stroke, increased cancer rates, dementia. Evidence on diabetes and obesity is emerging too. And as it said on the interview just done, the cumulative effect of this over a lifetime is really showing to be quite substantial. So we're seeing effects on increased rates of premature death by this insidious cumulative effect of the air pollution.
When we think about some of the diseases which might be impacted by air pollution, some of them you might expect, like asthma, but some of the other ones you've talked about, like dementia and obesity, seem less obvious. In a general terms, how does that work, do you think?
Again, this is an area where research is only just emerging, and I think the mechanisms aren't entirely clear. But we do know that all of these things are very closely interlinked. So whereas we might have thought of them as separate body parts, you know, the heart, the lungs, the brain, in fact, they're all joined together by your cardiovascular system and your lymphatic system. And the way in which the body copes with toxins, the way in which it responds to insult of this sort, is much more of a kind of systemic thing than localised to individual organs. So this is new science, and I think it's areas that really do need further research. We do see epidemics, if you like, of obesity, diabetes and dementia, which are affecting people at a younger and younger age, and we have to take into account the air we breathe as a contributor to those chronic diseases.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but I've brought up three children in London. As you heard there, one of them runs regularly through London. What additional risks is somebody in an air-polluted place running in particular? What specific risks are they running?
Well, what's hard about this is looking at an individual level, but I do think the evidence shows, obviously, that the most vulnerable people are the very young, the very old and pregnant women, but all of us. And I've also been brought up in London. My children now live in Cambridge, which has its own air pollution problems. The evidence suggests that at a population level, these risks are real. It's not just risks, it's actual damage to health at the moment. So I think, you know, the advice to your daughter, definitely avoiding busy roads. It's very hard for some people to avoid. They live on busy roads, their schools and hospitals are on busy roads. And really, that's an immediate response, but it can't be our long-term response to this problem.
I suppose what I really meant is, having brought children up from an early age, and not just in London or almost in any kind of city or largely polluted areas, a feeling of what it is that we've actually subjected to them over a lifetime of breathing this stuff in.
Well, I think, David, it's a hard truth that we have subjected ourselves and our children to health damage as a result. I don't think we can escape that. That's what the evidence shows us. And it's not something that we can now reverse. I suppose we can try to minimise it going forward by taking the sorts of advice that your interviewee suggested. But for some people, it's easier to avoid. For other people, certainly in poorer and disadvantaged communities, it's extremely hard to avoid the kinds of air pollution that are currently causing really quite serious damage to their health.
Now, we had some suggestions there of the things that actually cause the pollution. That was a particularly kind of nasty set of references to the sort of soup of materials created by traffic and so on. What are the mechanisms whereby these various things affect our health? And we talked about what kind of health problems there are, but how does it work?
Well, I think these are only just beginning to emerge. I mean, we can all picture the mechanism by which, if you breathe in actual particulates, very small particulates, and also these toxic gases, the nitrogen dioxide and ozone, you can understand how those deposited in the lungs and small enough to cross over into the bloodstream can cause great damage around the body. These can be deposited in organs of the body. There's metals in there. There's other toxins. There's carcinogens, which over a period of time can cause, you know, chronic damage to organ structures within the body. I think what's happening to the science is the epidemiology. That's the science of what happens to populations is alerting us to the more extensive toxic effects of this, as you say, this soup of poisons that the body is taking in. And it's that epidemiological evidence that's causing us to look more closely at the actual physical mechanisms that are going on inside the body. And the research continues.
So what you're saying is we now know things. We know things as of today that we didn't know 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yes, I think when we talked about the smogs back in the 50s, that A, the smog was very visible, so people could understand that it was going to cause damage to health. And it seemed to be a very much an acute thing. People who already had lung and heart disease were dying at the time. But the idea of this insidious cumulative effect of what is largely an invisible poison toxic mix that we're inhaling is much more tricky to kind of take on board. And it's very, very important that the part of the response to this is the research, the long-term follow-up of populations and really making sure we invest in that research so we can make a credible case to governments around the world and populations around the world that change is essential and urgent.
So how do we actually quantify the effects, what we lose as a consequence of air pollution?
So the estimates are that we lose about 6 million sick days each year. That also includes over 20,000 people admitted to hospital with breathing and heart problems, and an estimated cost to society each year of nearly £22.5 billion per year. So this is about a fifth of the annual budget of the NHS in England.
As an individual living in a city or living in an area which has high air pollution, is there anything that you can do to reduce significantly the risk either to yourself or to your children?
Absolutely. Walking and cycling in the side streets and in green parts of cities rather than on the main roads has been shown to quite markedly drop your intake of air pollutants. Sitting in a car in traffic actually turns out to be one of the worst things you can do. So taking public transport, although that too exposes you to air pollution if in heavy traffic. But there is evidence to say that people who take public transport are healthier. That's because they tend to walk further. So I think the general message is do walk, do cycle, do so on side streets, take public transport, and then you can also have the benefit of knowing you're not contributing to the problem.
Could you actually reverse the effects if you were to, say, move to the countryside?
I don't know that there's any evidence on that, but if you take smoking as an example, which may be a good analogy, we do know that stopping smoking now, however heavy your smoking history has been, immediately brings benefit to your health and survival length. So I think there is a good likelihood that moving to the country or working to improve your urban environment for yourself and your children will make an effect quite rapidly. We do know that even small changes in the amount of particulate matter in the environment can have immediate benefits on health.
Fiona Godley, this is far from being a little local difficulty. So now I want to find out how we compare to other countries and then to ask what can be done and what others are already doing to stop us slowly poisoning ourselves and our children. To help me with these questions, I've welcomed into the briefing room Audrey de Nazel, Senior Lecturer at the Centre for Environmental Policy at Imperial College, and Gavin Shaddick, Professor of Data Science and Statistics at the University of Exeter, who leads the World Health Organization Task Force on Global Air Quality. Gavin Shaddick, you produced a very detailed report on air pollution along with the World Health Organization this year. Can you outline for us what the situation is as of now in the United Kingdom?
Well, when we did the report with the World Health Organization, we estimated the levels of air pollutant known as particulate matter 2.5, which are very, very small particles that are small enough to get through our kind of natural barriers and defense into our respiratory systems and cause some quite serious adverse health effects. When we looked at the global picture, we saw that approximately 90% of people worldwide lived in areas where the levels of PM2.5, particulate air pollution, were higher than the WHO safe limits, which are 10 micrograms per meter cubed. When we looked at the UK, we found that number was around 67%. So around two-thirds of the population in the UK currently are living in areas where level, annual average PM2.5 is above this WHO limit.
Now, just give us a guide. The WHO limit, what does it actually mean?
So the WHO limit was set up based on an evaluation of the health effects of air pollution, both at very high and quite low levels, so covering a whole range between the kind of exposures we might expect in Western countries compared with those in low and middle income countries. It's a number that's been arrived at basically by taking in the evidence relating increased levels of air pollution, in particular PM2.5 in this case, and a range of health effects from things that we might expect to be associated with air pollution, such as lung cancer, coronary obstructive pulmonary disease and other respiratory conditions, but also ones that affect our cardiovascular system, such as stroke and ischemic heart disease.
How far above the WHO limit are our worst polluted areas in the UK?
Compared with major cities in China and India, which have annual averages maybe 5 to 7 times greater than the WHO limit, in Britain we are only a relatively smaller amount above. The range in Britain goes between around 8 micrograms per metre cubed, which is below the limit in some of our more rural areas, up to about 16 micrograms per metre cubed. So two ways of looking at that. Either it's only 6 above the limit, or it's a fairly substantial percentage or proportion increase.
OK. Now, if I can turn to you, Audrey de Nazel, what do you think about the solutions adopted so far to tackle air pollution in this country? In London, there was the congestion charge, we've had the T charge, we've had the purchase of low-emission buses and their use in some places.
Yeah, so in the UK in general, and London in particular, a lot of the discourse around tackling air pollution is very much technologically focused, and trying to improve our fuels, our engines, our emissions control. And certainly that plays an important part. It's absolutely necessary to think of technologies to improve our air pollution. But my view on this is it's a very narrow-minded approach because we're just missing out an opportunity for much more holistic thinking about improving health. And I think what often happens is that we tend to forget why it is that we want to reduce air pollution. And the reason we want to, if you want to guess, is that we want to improve our health. So if we make health our end goal of our air pollution policies, then we probably want to think of a much different picture than those very technologically driven approaches. So to take a concrete example, if you think of the way we might change our urban design so that we change the way we plan our cities, the purpose of our streets, let's say streets right now are really conceived to be for cars to go from A to B, but let's think of streets being actually meant for people to be able to walk and bike safely to go places, for people to interact, for children to play. Then if we try to tackle air pollution through this much more holistic perspective of changing our behaviors and changing our quality of life in our cities, then we can get much more bang for our buck than if we only look at technological solutions. So I see air pollution as a fantastic opportunity for a much more holistic thinking about promotion of health in our cities.
Okay, let's park that thought for the moment. It's really, it's a really important one and so on. If at the moment we talk about the solutions we've adopted so far and their actual impact, Gavin Chandy, can we see any significant difference made by the technological approach before we come to the holistic approach?
Well, in terms of technology and the kind of interventions that have been tried so far, so increased efficiency of engines and also things like low emission zones in cities, I think part of the problem with those is that just by reducing the exhaust emissions, for example, out of diesel vehicles, does not reduce the levels of pollution down to kind of zero or very low levels, because a component of the particulate air pollution is actually made up of things like brake dust, tyre wear and resuspension of dust from roads, all of which have the potential to be kind of highly toxic in our air. So I think although a reduction in the emissions and certainly a reduction in the diesel emissions from vehicles is to be welcomed and would have an effect on health, I think probably more substantially would be to actually reduce the number of vehicles on the road. And for that, I think we need a behavioural change. And I think part of the problem at the moment is walking or cycling down a busy street, which is potentially high in air pollution, is not a particularly attractive alternative to being in a vehicle or driving your own car.
Nor is it necessarily a healthy one, which, if you don't mind my just mentioning this, because I think it's important, we do tend to think that air pollution might, mostly car traffic is a deterrent, I think, for people to walk and bike. They get scared of being, and with good reason, scared of being run over by a car. Air pollution becomes increasingly also a deterrent. People are worried about their exposures and air pollution. And we are starting to see that for older people and some respiratory health outcomes. So it means that even the things that we know are such important determinants of health, such as physical activity, is reduced because high levels of air pollution.
Yeah, I think that's a really subtle point, isn't it? Which is that healthy behaviour is actually curtailed by both the fear and the reality of the other effects that you can gain. I want to concentrate a little bit on, say, those countries which have had very high levels of pollution in cities. I mean, I'm thinking particularly of Beijing during the 2008 Olympics. It famously did some things, didn't it, to try. I mean, how successful were they and what did they do?
They essentially switched off factories for a while. They reduced road traffic considerably. And more recently in Beijing, where there have been some fairly strong measures to reduce air pollution within the city, almost entire blocks of settlements where people used solid fuels for example, lighting and heating and cooking, which was causing a lot of ambient or outdoor air pollution. Those settlements have essentially been knocked down and replaced with more modern, efficient buildings. But these kind of almost drastic or extensive interventions are possibly not as easy to implement in the UK.
You mean they're not easy to implement in democracies where you can't just tell people what to do and knock down whole neighbourhoods and not have riots?
Yes.
Okay. Now, presumably, there are some kind of intermediate places where they've also had significant problems of air pollution. The one that springs to mind that I seem to recollect, but maybe I'm wrong, was Mexico City.
Yeah, well, Mexico City used to be one of the most polluted cities on Earth. Now, it's no longer quite as high up the league table, a league table that we really don't want to be at the top of. But they have had policies such as only allowing cars with certain registration plates to drive on certain days, so maybe every other day, at certain very high pollution episodes. They have reduced car traffic considerably.
Some cities do resort to these very short-term, just the same way that Beijing did during the Olympics, or for example Paris also during a high peak episode also asked half of the cars with the even numbers not to go out. But they work one day. They certainly are not a policy for the long term. I mean, I think some cities like Athens had tried to make it long term, Mexico tries to make it long term, but eventually people just buy more cars. So they're certainly not sustainable. I think to have sustainable solutions you need to be thinking much more forward.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's talk about one technological solution which is always raised, which is moving towards all electric vehicles. What kind of impact might that have?
electric vehicles are beneficial in terms of their reduction in exhaust fumes, but they also have tire and brake wear. So they won't really decrease so much the particulate matter that's emitted, only partly, so they're not quite as efficient as simply getting rid of cars. But also you have to produce the electricity, and how effective electric vehicles are reducing overall air pollution depends on how that electricity is produced.
Okay, well, let's go to the fun bit. I presume that in order to be particularly effective, you'd actually have to take a more radical approach. And of course, for a radical approach, there will be cost. So let's look at where people have done more radical things and had more radical results, Audrey.
Yeah, so I think that's the very positive thing that's happening in that around the world, I think, is that people are starting to realize that you can start envisioning a very new way of looking at cities and what streets are for. So there are cities like Hamburg, Paris, Oslo, Madrid, have all called for much more drastic approaches to cut down cars to become car-free or car-less. So, for example, to take the case of Barcelona, they have a new planning approach called superblocks, supermanzanas in Spanish, where every third street is devoted to traffic and particular public transportation. But you have a whole network of streets within that are walking friendly, cycling friendly, children friendly. They have little park areas at every intersection. So it creates a whole network around the city so that you can safely walk and bike to go places. Now, they've only implemented these in small areas, but their vision is to implement them throughout the city. And other places like Oslo have really tried to increase their public transportation, make walking and cycling easier. And then if you think back historically, Holland, Amsterdam, for example, or Copenhagen made the choice many years ago back in the 1970s that they were going to create those cycling networks and reduce the space of cars. We tend to think that Dutch people have a DNA associated with cycling. It's a cultural thing, but it's not
and
at
it's
all.
Flat.
It's also flat, but it's very windy, so it's not always easy to bike. But there was a political decision back in the 1970s that they should go towards increasing cycling. And so it is a political decision that needs to be made at one point, and it can't be very effective.
Now, Gavin Shadick, you've been involved with the World Health Organization, and presumably that's given you some kind of understanding of where politicians see their limitations in terms of policy. I mean, put simply, why don't they just do and argue for the kinds of changes that are going on in places like Amsterdam, Barcelona, Oslo and so on?
Well, I completely agree with Audrey that what we really need is a behavioural change, both as individuals and actually a kind of policy change to encourage active travel and not just say you have to cycle to work and you should walk to work, but actually to make that more attractive. And with that comes not just reduced air pollution, but other health benefits to do with increased exercise. In terms of why this is not quite as simple as just saying, let's do it, well, globally, at least, the emissions that lead to high levels of air pollution are largely to do with growing economies. And in some sense, there's a kind of a balance between economic output and air pollution that's generated. It's not quite as simple, that relationship. But in order to reduce air pollution from things like industries, then obviously there's got to be a major change in the way we look at how industry works and how we generate energy for industry and for transportation.
One final question. We're awaiting the publication of the UN's climate change report next week. Does the argument for cleaner air feed into the argument about emissions?
Yes, I think we've been doing some work with the World Health Organization and other institutions have been looking at the potential co-benefits of carbon emissions related to climate change and potential effects on air pollution, for example, particulate matter, and then on the effects of health. I think it's important to realise that if you reduce emissions from a particular source by 10%, you wouldn't necessarily expect concentrations of air pollution to reduce by 10%. We wouldn't expect our intake or our exposures that we breathe in to reduce 10%, and nor the adverse health outcomes. So I think we need to really try to understand the links between emissions, concentrations, what we breathe in, and the effects on our health. But also to realise that we need to think about these things again in a very broad sense and to be aware that as well as co-benefits, we might need to factor in potential adverse effects of reducing, for example, emissions in something at one location, that just moves it to another location where there might be a more populated area. So I think with all of these things, and certainly the link between climate change legislation and the potential and the desire for reduced air pollution, is to tease out where we are most optimally going to reduce both.
Gavin Shaddick there and Audrey Denazelle. And my conclusion, the consensus of this discussion, seems to be that if you want to stop poisoning the air, there's no technological quick fix. It's going to need a culture change. My thanks to Andrew Grieve, Fiona Godley, Audrey Denazelle and Gavin Shaddick. And we'll be back next Thursday. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. The producers were Neil Koenig, Serena Tarling and Tom Hill. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We like hearing from you.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4. History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.